Catherine Harris-Nave. Catherine is a PhD, a fourth-year doctoral student, a PhD candidate in history at Rutgers University. Her research focuses on the British Isles in the late 17th and early 18th century, with an emphasis on state formation, immigration, citizenship and identity, and religious toleration in both imperial and European and imperial contexts. Last year, she was a graduate fellow at the Rutgers Center for Historical Analysis, and she is currently working on her dissertation proposal for a project on Huguenot refugees in the British Isles. This is her first professional conference. So please join me in welcoming Catherine, whose topic today is Naturalizing Refugees, How Foreign Protestants Became British in the 18th Century.
In 1704, the English, soon to be British, Parliament passed the Private Bill of Naturalization for one Peter Renoir. From the Renoir family archives, we can trace Peter, or rather Pierre's, journey to becoming legally British. His itinerary traverses Western Europe, crossing the borders of France, the Netherlands, Spain, and Britain. Pierre was born in Paris in 1680 to a Protestant family. Around that time, King Louis XIV of France renewed persecution of Protestants living in the country, which culminated with the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685. The Renoirs, along with 200,000 French nationals, fled their homeland in hopes of finding religious protection and a new life abroad. The Renoir family settled in Holland, and the two sons, Pierre and David, attended school in Utrecht. Following in the footsteps of his older brother, Pierre ran away from school in 1696 to join the Royal Dragoons of William of Orange, newly crowned King William III of England, Scotland, and Ireland. Pierre stayed on with the troops to serve in the War of Spanish Succession. In 1704, in the midst of this war, a, quote, Peter Renoir, son of David Renoir by Mary, his wife, end quote, was naturalized in England. After 51 years of service in 12 campaigns with his adopted country's army, Colonel Renoir died in his bed in Dublin in 1762. At the end of his life, had the colonel become Peter, or would he always remain Pierre? The answer to this question is not what name did his friends and family call him, nor is the answer the name on the Bill of Naturalization. Sometimes those names were anglicized during the process, and sometimes they were not. I ask instead, what was the national identity of Renoir? On paper, the Bill of Naturalization granted him the privilege of a natural-born Englishman. Yet the political debate surrounding the en masse naturalization of foreign Protestants in the British Isles points to the reticence in embracing even Protestant refugees into the national body. When Renoir applied for naturalization in 1704, he had to get a private bill passed through Parliament specifically naturalizing him and his descendants. Alien residents who wanted the privileges of natural-born Englishmen had to retain a lawyer to draft a private bill, which was then presented to Parliament, voted upon to be read twice, passed through committee, and finally voted into action by both the House of Commons and the House of Lords. The process was both costly and risky, given the potential for the bills to fail or for Parliament to dissolve before the final vote. In this paper, I consider the passage of the 1709 Act of General Naturalization of Foreign Protestants in the British Parliament, which eliminated the need for private bills. The debates surrounding this bill highlight the attitudes towards foreigners, especially towards the influx of 50,000 Huguenot refugees that settled throughout the British Isles. The debates and the language of the bill also reflect a broader discourse about who could or should belong in the national polity of Britons. This debate took place in the context of the 1707 unification of England and Scotland, which created a single British government with a peculiar arrangement for separate established state churches. I argue that the presence of Huguenot immigrants and the subsequent rejection of a second wave of Protestant refugees, this time from the Palatinate, crystallized the legal national identity of Britons in the 18th century. Ultimately, the General Act was repealed in 1712, demonstrating the limitations of a pan-Protestant British identity. Other scholars like Daniel Statt have focused more on the economic issues at stake in the discussion of naturalization. Since the two major political parties, Tories and Whigs, of the late 17th and early 18th century conceptualized national wealth in very different ways, they also held different views on how immigration affected that wealth. Generally speaking, Tories held the opinion that immigrants would hurt the national wealth. Poor immigrants would require assistance, whereas the rich ones might send their wealth home or take resources away from English-born subjects. The latter was of particular concern to the holders of the Tory opinion. With regard to the Huguenots, since a large number of them were skilled artisans in a variety of trades, Whigs tended to view the skills of these immigrants as a potential boon to the economy. At the time, English tract writers developed the theory that the greater the population of a country, the greater the country's growth in national wealth. Through labor, national wealth was infinitely expandable. This idea informed John Locke's opinion in his 1693 tract for general naturalization. It followed that if a greater population could produce greater wealth, then efforts to increase the population through immigration, such as simplifying the process of naturalization, would benefit the nation. It was not until a Whig majority favorable to immigration was voted into Parliament that the General Naturalization Bill finally succeeded and was made law. However, the economic considerations cannot fully capture the anxieties and hopes of Tories and Whigs with regard to the refugee population. For this, I turn to the religious dimension of the Huguenots' legal acceptance. The Act of General Naturalization named two religious requirements for the naturalization process, the sacrament and an oath of allegiance. These placed limits on the otherwise universalizing economic theory laid out in the first line of the Act. In accordance to the Whiggish idea of the growth of national wealth, it explicitly states that the reason for this act is that, quote, the increase of people is a means of advancing wealth and strength of a nation, end quote. However, it mattered that those people all shared an investment in the Protestant or Reformed religion. Therefore, only foreign nationals who, quote, shall have received the sacrament of the Lord's Supper in some Protestant or Reformed congregation within this kingdom of Great Britain, end quote, could naturalize. Where the sacrament could be received, a Protestant or Reformed church, and Reformed here just means further along in the Reformation, usually of Calvinist faith, but the Huguenots often were more Calvinist-leading. The Protestant and Reformed church requirement reflects the debates over the course of the 17th century about churches in the kingdoms of the crown. Since the break with Rome under Henry VIII, the Church of England, with an episcopal ecclesiastical structure, had been the official established religion of the English state. That did not mean that all practicing Christians in England or even the Stuart kingdoms adhered to that religion. Arguments over toleration of non-conforming Protestants, often Presbyterians, and even of Catholics intensified in the 17th century. In the 1670s and 1680s, the Crown sponsored toleration with the Declarations of Indulgence, which limited the penal enforcements of religious conformity first against Protestants and eventually against Catholics. Toleration was met with strong popular backlash, fueled by a widespread fear of popery. Parliament passed test acts to control the religious beliefs of holders of office, which included the sacramental test and oaths of loyalty to the Church of England. A more minimal act of toleration passed in 1689 during the reign of William and Mary, which gave parliamentary sanction to free worship for non-conforming Protestants. Still excluded from toleration were anti-Trinitarian sects of Protestantism, atheists, and Catholics. The acceptance of non-conformists meant that Protestant refugees with Calvinist leanings who fled war and persecution could settle in England without embracing the specific doctrines of the Church of England. The Tory contingent in the 1709 Parliament, however, did not find this wording satisfactory. In addition to being anti-immigrant, Tory party politics also favored conformity within the Church of England. One Mr. Henry Campion insisted that the bill be changed to require, quote, such foreigners as should be willing to enjoy the benefit of it to receive the sacrament according to the usage of the Church of England, end quote. His amendment also voiced an anti-naturalization pamphlet circulating outside of Parliament, which accused foreign nationals of any religion to be spies and enemies, and that under the pretense of naturalization, quote, the professed enemies of our established church and religion might flock over with design to effect their overthrow, end quote. Under the assumptions of the pamphlet, immigrants, even those that naturalized, shifted only their legal status, not their religious and national loyalties. It is important here to highlight that the target of the naturalization bill was the Huguenot refugee population, the French Protestants fleeing the alleged enemy state. The pamphlet and Campion's amendment reflect how anti-popery, the fear of Catholic influence in England, expanded to a general xenophobia. For instance, Robert Hubert, a Huguenot watchmaker, was executed for causing the Great Fire of London in 1666, which he didn't have anything to do with. Deeply held prejudices against foreigners, especially against the French, carried into the 18th century. However, it is not just generosity to foreign Protestants that made Campion's demand untenable and illegal in the Parliament of 1709. That Parliament was the newly formed British Parliament that included representatives from both England and Scotland. In 1707, just 2 years earlier, the Union of England and Scotland had created a single government of Great Britain in which there would be a single British Parliament. Crucial to the settlement was a pair of bills, the Acts of Security, which guaranteed the supremacy of two state churches, one Episcopal in England and the other Presbyterian in Scotland. This arrangement reaffirmed the settlement of a Presbyterian Church of Scotland from 1690, creating ecclesiastically separate churches within the kingdoms under the crown's control. It is from the combination of representatives of kingdoms with two different state churches that the oath of loyalty required for naturalization derives. In the oath, all members of Parliament had to renounce transubstantiation, as well as the adoration and invocation of the Virgin Mary and saints. Furthermore, the oath taker also had to reject the authority of the Pope and the tenets of the Church of Rome as, quote, superstitious and idolatrous. The clear group excluded by the text of the oath were Catholics. Belonging to the British nation demanded a statement of religious belief dictated by the Union settlement of churches. Whereas ideas about political economy drove the project to encourage immigration, pan-Protestantism was the force imagined to hold that British interest together. From the Union and Act of Naturalization, two defining characteristics emerge. First, to be British meant contributing to the national wealth of Britain in an expanding colonial system. Second, to be British also meant to identify and practice a Protestant faith. Allegiance to Britain was dependent upon that demonstration of faith. These defining characteristics presented an early 18th century experiment of how to bring together peoples of different national birth under one national interest, which would prove essential to the success of empire. However, within a few years of the act, a Tory majority in Parliament repealed the piece of legislation in 1712, exposing the limits of that inclusive project. General naturalization was deemed a failure, an expensive mistake brought on by an overly enthusiastic Whiggish Parliament, too sympathetic to foreigners. Within months of the passing of the Act of Naturalization, refugees from the wars in the Rhine region of the Holy Roman Empire began to flood into England. By the end of the summer, 13,000 had arrived. They fled war, poverty, and life under a Catholic elector, even though the elector did not actively pursue, persecute the Protestant Palatines of Reformed and Lutheran faiths. The French invasion of the Palatinate and bad harvest launched a mass migration. Unfortunately, the plan to absorb Protestant immigrants into the British workforce and thus augment the wealth of the country quickly proved unfeasible. The Protestant Palatines were considered destitute, in ill health, and largely unskilled. They required massive poor relief and financial aid, now at the expense of the British government. Although the negative reaction to the Palatine refugees did lead to the repeal of the Act of Naturalization, it is unlikely that the piece of legislation was the attraction for the mass migration. Since the rights of a natural-born since the rights of natural-born Britons awarded mostly economic benefits, poor immigrants with nothing to pass down through inheritance had little need for naturalization. Of the 933 names total naturalized in 1709, most were French. When the House of Commons investigated the influx of Germans in 1711, they discovered German language books and pamphlets advertising free land in the colonies for those who went to Britain, not advertisements for easy naturalization. Very few of the Palatines remained in the British metropole. Some left for the colonies, but many simply returned home as things settled down. The large number that came to Britain, if only for a brief time, were poor refugees in ill health in need of relief. With the expenses attached to helping these refugees, the act of naturalization by association with immigration was branded a failure and quickly repealed. The failure of naturalization under the challenges presented by the Palatine refugees served as an important lesson for the British imperial model. Whereas economic and religious interest could work to tie diverse groups of people to a single national British interest, it was not enough to create an integrated yet diverse British society in the metropole. Protestantism was not enough to allay the fears of anti-naturalization pamphleteer that frequent intermarriages would extinguish the English race. In the eyes of xenophobic native Britons, there was no way to safely encourage immigration. The naturalized foreigner will always remain the other within, despite what legal definitions of belonging might say. National identities, whether English, Scottish, or French, continue to matter, even if individuals also were connected by British interest. An individual French Protestant could go through the effort of a private bill of naturalization in Britain post the repeal, as shown by Pierre or Peter Renouard, a Parisian exiled in the Netherlands who joined the English army to protect a Dutch monarch ruling in the British Isles, naturalized in England in order to fight in Spain, and ultimately settled down in Ireland. However, not all Pierres could also be Peters. Thank you.